From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is Please Explain. Think of any major medical procedure and imagine what it would be like without anesthesia. Nightmarish. Anesthesia has made modern medicine possible, and we're going to talk about that on today's edition of Please Explain. I'm joined by Dr. Doris Cope, professor of anesthesiology and director of the pain medicine program at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. She's an expert in the history of anesthesiology. And Dr. William Schechter, clinical professor of anesthesiology and pediatrics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Columbia University. He's also with the Pediatric Pain Management Center at Columbia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Cope, what was it like for people who had any kind of surgery before modern anesthesia? What did they do?
First of all, they didn't have the kind of surgical procedures that we have today. They had quick amputations, and the quality of a surgeon was measured by how quick he could be.
To some degree, isn't that still true?
Well, actually, anesthesia provides the luxury of doing very deep surgery, very delicate surgery, certainly cardiac surgery, eye surgery, brain surgery that could never have been done without anesthesia.
But in the old days, they could use hypnosis?
They
could ice something down?
The surgery was limited to chopping a leg off or chopping a finger off or very, very limited procedures.
Uh-huh. And they'd give you as much alcohol as possible and tell you to bite the bullet.
Well, not even that. Sometimes they would just hold a patient down. In China, there's a famous picture of an emperor who used mind control and was playing a chess game while they amputated part of his body. So there was hypnotism, there was brute force, there was alcohol, but the procedures directly evolved, surgical procedures directly evolved in complexity and in risk after surgical anesthesia was developed.
I assume that the word comes from the Greek. What does it mean?
Anesthesia was coined by Oliver Wendell Holmes. It's a state of not being aware of an or without anesthesia, being able to sense or experience.
When did researchers begin to move toward using things like laughing gas or ether or chloroform?
Laughing gas was used in the 1700s, early 1800s, as a recreational gas. There in England, there was a pneumatic institute in the late 1700s, and Humphrey Davies did a lot of work at the Medical Pneumatic Institute in Bristol in the late 1780s, 1790s, and developed nitrous oxide in 1800. And he actually pulled out one of his own wisdom teeth under nitrous oxide. Then laughing gas was used for medical students and for demonstrations, and Crawford Long in Georgia was the first one in the United States and actually was the first one to actually willfully undertake a procedure using inhalation anesthesia.
Mm-hmm. That was ether?
That was ether. They had ether frolics, and he had experienced some of those.
So does that mean that anesthesia really is something that was developed in the United States?
Yes, it's a distinctly American specialty of medicine. We're very proud of that.
Dentists and others, even barbers, gave anesthesia in the early days, didn't they?
In the early days, it was considered not the practice of medicine as much as a technique. And as things became more complex and patients required more monitoring, more care, it became a specialty of medicine. And that was in the 1930s. It became a subspecialty, first of surgery and then a subspecialty on its own.
Dr. Schechter, I understand that when you first began practicing medicine in the 1970s, you wondered whether you would have enough nerve for it because of how dangerous it seemed.
Well, when I was a medical student, I recall vividly going into the operating room and watching a patient put to sleep by an IV injection. And it seemed as if the patient was in a black box. All that we really had was an EKG. We had no idea as to whether or not the patient was breathing adequately unless the stethoscope was placed in just the right location. And the anesthesiologist seemed quite cavalier. He was an excellent anesthesiologist. He was actually the chairman of the department. And I said to myself, gee, I could never do this.
Because you didn't have all the monitors, all the things. You had to just watch the patient like a hawk.
Precisely.
And what happened if you suspected that you were losing them?
Well, obviously, these people were expert clinicians who were very capable of determining depth of anesthesia using clinical signs and symptoms and the monitors that were available at the time, and they were able to do so very safely.
But I suspect we know a lot more now than we did 35 years ago.
Absolutely. The trend in anesthesia today is for improved and increasing amounts of monitoring.
Well, anyone who's ever gone under general anesthesia probably has had the sense that it's the anesthesiologist who holds their life in their hands, so to speak. What does it really mean to go under?
Well, I think to some degree that's true. We are people that bring you to the brink, so to speak, and return you to consciousness.
When you say bring us to the brink, you bring us to the line between life and death?
Well, I think what we do is we administer medications that will affect the cardiorespiratory system, affect the ability of the patient to breathe on his own, and also we render the patient unconscious. So these are very, very potent drugs that we use and very important techniques that we employ.
Where are we physically at that time?
Well, that's a good question. Anesthesia certainly isn't sleep. I always cringe being a pediatric anesthesiologist when a parent says, okay, the doctor's going to put you to sleep now, just like Buffy went to sleep in the veterinarian's office. And I think it's important for the audience to know that anesthesia is not sleep. You can be aroused from sleep because of a noise or a painful stimulus. You can't with anesthesia. The EEG is also very different. The normal non-REM pattern and REM pattern of sleep is not present. There is a suppressed level of activity during anesthesia.
And why is it important to bring us to that state?
Well, we want the patient to be at a state of anesthesia that allows the patient to tolerate a noxious stimulus, not only to be unaware of the painful stimulus, but also achieve a state whereby the reflexes, which are so important during awake life that protect us, are not acting in a way that might endanger us. For example, when we have a desire to cough, that is a laryngeal reflex. We really don't want the patient to close his vocal cords and not be able to breathe under anesthesia, and that requires a deep level of anesthesia.
My guests on Please Explain today are Dr. William Schechter of Columbia and Dr. Doris Cope of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. The topic is anesthesia. This is WNYC 93.9. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Cope, aren't there categories of anesthesia? Do lay people have it right when they refer to general, local, and regional anesthesia?
There are categories. Anesthesia is without pain, and not all anesthesia is a general anesthetic, which you would lose consciousness. A number of procedures are done on a regional technique, such as epidural anesthesia for obstetrical deliveries, regional anesthesia on extremities, orthopedic surgery, and certainly local for removal of a small boil or a wart would be done under local anesthesia with maybe even IV sedation.
Or the dentist drilling my teeth.
Yeah, a lot of procedures are done, like a colonoscopy, with IV sedation. It's not a total general anesthetic. The patient is still responsive. They're analgesic. They don't have pain, but they're not totally anesthetized.
Do we know just how some of these drugs work, or do we just know that they work?
We certainly know how the pain medications work and how the muscle relaxants work. But the general anesthetics, there's still a lot of research and a lot of controversy about what exactly is happening in the brain when someone loses consciousness.
Dr. Schechter, what is the process like from the time that you meet the anesthesiologist to when you're going into surgery?
Well, certainly the anesthesiologist very often has a daunting task of instilling a certain degree of confidence in the patient and helping by that initial interaction to allay any anxiety that the patient may have. Anesthesia departments today are now changing their name to anesthesiology and perioperative medicine because we are taking very, very ill patients to the operating room with increasing frequency, and many of these patients have complex disease. So it is our task to ensure that they're in the optimal medical condition for the induction of anesthesia.
So you have to weigh a bunch of things like how old a person is, what kind of physical state.
Cardiac function, respiratory function, renal function, what medications they may be on, which may interact with anesthetics.
But basically you go in there and they stick an IV in you and then they give you something like Valium, don't they?
Yeah, if the patient is undergoing a general anesthetic or a regional technique, very often an IV is started with the patient awake. This is not necessarily true for children. And the first drug that's given is a benzodiazepine, like Valium. And the most commonly used drug today is a drug called midazolam, which is a very potent, short-acting anxiolytic. It makes the patient somewhat blissfully unaware of the consequences of what is going to happen. It usually doesn't put the patient to sleep. They can be completely conversant, but they're a bit more relaxed. And then the patient is brought into the operating room and monitors are applied. And we routinely monitor blood pressure, heart rate. One of the most important monitors that we use today routinely is something called a pulse oximeter, which allows us on a beat-to-beat basis to measure the amount of oxygen that's in the bloodstream, giving everybody a great deal of confidence.
You give the patient a drug to immobilize him or her, too.
Well, we would then give the patient a drug that will put him or her to sleep, induce the state of hypnosis or unconsciousness, as it is called. And that drug in the past was sodium pentothal, or today...
That's when I used to tell the truth during operations.
Yeah.
Did anybody ever tell the truth under sodium pentothal, or is that just simply a spy movie idea?
Gosh, I don't know.
My understanding of that is that it makes a person uninhibited, but most people, by the time you receive the drug and go to sleep, it's not very much time. You couldn't say but two words. There's not much time there to tell much of anything.
Yeah,
I've never heard anybody reveal secrets under anesthesia.
I want to second that. I don't think people have to be afraid that they're going to spill some secret or say things that they would regret later. They will fall asleep. With the drugs that we're using now, such as propofol, sleep is within seconds of the administration of the agent.
And then there's going to be pain after the operation. So do you then start giving them drugs to handle the pain when they come out?
Well, you know, unlike other areas of medicine, such as infectious diseases, where you would target an antibiotic for a particular bacteria, in anesthesia we use a multimodal approach. So the patient gets a drug to fall asleep and then gets usually an opioid to alleviate pain both during the operation and afterwards.
Some operations take longer than others, and some surgeons are quicker than others. Is that something you have to consider as well?
Of course.
And then I know I had cataract surgery once, and I didn't go completely under. Mm-hmm. So I guess the final stage, the immobilizing drug, was not administered. I was just kept in a kind of a sleepy, twilighty, dreamy state.
Right. For cataract surgery, very typically, you will receive a local anesthetic block, and for that block, you will get a dose of sleep medicine that will last for only a very, very brief period of time, and then an anxiolytic, and really you're awake during that procedure.
Dr. Cope, it's often said that in some ways the anesthesiologist is also the acting psychiatrist in any operating room. Is that true?
I think that was a comment that I've heard often, that the anesthesiologist is the psychiatrist of the operating room, because it is our job to set the tone with the patient, to coordinate with the surgeons, the nurses, and the entire team to keep things calm and smooth and going well. I think if a surgeon became exasperated, people wouldn't be that surprised. But if an anesthesiologist said, oh, my gosh, I think the whole OR would be in shock.
They have to calm everybody else down.
Right.
We don't think about it this way usually, but by definition, anesthesiologists are the leading medical experts in resuscitation, aren't they?
That's
if you
correct.
Put us under, you have to be able to bring us back.
That's correct. And we also, the surgeons, you know, in a good team, the surgeons and anesthesiologists are colleagues. They're both physicians that care about what's happening to the patient. And if we, as an anesthesiologist, sense there's a drop in blood pressure or the heart's not working well or the lungs is a problem, we tell the surgeons, and then that may modify their plan, or if they expect something is going to happen, they might be losing some blood, they'll tell us. So we kind of work as teammates or collaborators, physician partners, to make sure the patient does well surgically and also their anesthesia.
Doctors sometimes are criticized for playing God, but in the case of an anesthesiologist, isn't that what you're doing to some degree? You really have a person under your control.
Our goal is to get them to their baseline or better, so we're not really changing their life. Hopefully, we're just taking an hour or two out of their life and giving them a pain-free, safe surgical experience.
We're acting with the utmost of beneficence. we really want the patient to have an experience that is not frightening, that is not painful, and we want them to know that although they are unconscious, they are being protected by someone who is watching over them during the procedure.
But do you feel the weight of that?
Absolutely.
You both also lead pain management programs. This is a fairly new area, isn't it?
Yes, it's very exciting. It's interventional anesthesiology. It's sort of, the cutting edge of where we're going in our science and some of our new techniques.
But it grows naturally out of what you've been doing all along.
That's correct.
I would assume because you've always been involved in pain management.
That's correct.
So what are some of the new things that are being done, Dr. Schechter?
Well, you know, I'm an individual that works exclusively with children, and I've always been surprised by the belief that many people have that young children can't process pain, infants don't feel pain, and in fact, for many years, infants underwent anesthesia with just a muscle relaxant and an oxygen technique. We now know that children do feel pain, and that the experience of pain early in childhood may have consequences for the perception of pain later in life and may have some behavioral effects as well. So I think it's very important to recognize that many disease states can be associated with pain, and they need to be treated in a multimodal way, i.e., using biobehavioral techniques, psychotherapy, medications, and in some cases, rare cases in the instance of caring for children, nerve blocks.
Anesthesiology was once rated as a class 5 operation procedure. Now it's been downgraded to class 3. So why is that? Has all the monitoring made it a lot safer?
Well, I think it is certainly true that anesthesiology is much safer today than it used to be, and I think it will be yet safer in the future as we gain a better appreciation for how general anesthetics work. We'll be able to target specific receptors as our knowledge of pharmacogenetics improves. We'll be able to tailor anesthetics to individual patients in a more a safe and effective manner.
Dr. Cope, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I also think monitoring has. We can do monitoring very easily and not interventionally. We can monitor beat-to-beat EKGs. Before, they used to have to put little electrodes in the skin that were held down with clips. We get excellent EKGs. We have echoes of the heart. We can do periop in the surgery. We have the oxygen pulse oximeter, as Dr. Schechter mentioned. We can tell what gases are going in, what gases are going out. Our equipment is very, very high-tech, very specific to what we're doing. So I think the technology and the research that's been done in the area has certainly made the specialty much safer.
We're talking about anesthesia on today's Please Explain. I'm sure you have lots of questions. I'm sure quite a few of you have been operated on as well. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Dr. Doris Cope, Professor of Anesthesiology and Director of the Pain Medicine Program at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and Dr. William Schechter, clinical professor of anesthesiology and pediatrics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Columbia University. The number again, 212-433-9692. We'll be back right after this. We're back with today's edition of Please Explain, and Drs. William Schechter and Doris Cope, and your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, just one thing that I've been very curious about. Acupuncture, it seems to work, and in some places it's used instead of all of this. Do we know how it works, Dr. Cope?
Acupuncture, of course, as most people would probably know, is developed in ancient China and was used with drugs for pain control and for changing the state of consciousness. The early studies done in China with cardiac surgery under acupuncture, we found out later there's also very heavy opium pre-med sedation given as well. But in my experience, and we see a number of thousands of chronic pain patients, acupuncture best works, I think, in myofascial or muscular tension type pain. I've not seen it work in cancer pain or very severe pain, in which we have to employ more interventional methods.
There is some work being done on acupuncture in neonates. A colleague of mine at Boston Children's Hospital is using acupuncture to render the children more comfortable at times when they are being ventilated by a machine artificially. So it has an effect which we believe may in part be due to the release of endogenous opioids and can perhaps relieve pain by a mechanism that can easily be explained in Western terms.
Let's go to some of these calls. Amy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi. Actually, I have two questions. I hope there's time for both. One is... I was wondering if the increase in endoscopic surgery, where you don't actually have to make an open incision, is that reducing the use of general anesthesia?
No, on the contrary. Although minimally invasive techniques are wonderful, many of these techniques require maximally invasive anesthesia. It's not possible, for example, if you're going to have a laparoscopic abdominal procedure, to have that under a regional technique, because as part of the technique, they insufflate the abdominal cavity with gas, rendering it painful and also making it difficult for you to breathe on your own. And so general anesthesia is very often required for many of these minimally invasive procedures.
Amy, we have lots of calls, so I'm sorry we don't have time for the second question, but maybe somebody else will ask it. Sheila from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering whether either of the doctors could explain why so many of us women suffer from nausea when we wake up from anesthesia, and it can take a couple of days to get over it, and even I spent an extra day in the hospital just because of the nausea.
Well, that can be related, first of all, to the opiate medicines, the pain medicines, but also when someone is going under there, sometimes being masked with oxygen, and that air can go in the stomach and cause nausea as well.
Laughing gas, which is a common term used for nitrous oxide, may also play a role in the development of nausea and vomiting because it expands the bowel gas. It also gets into the middle ear and can cause some vertigo and nausea associated with that. Also, the type of surgical procedure that is being performed can have a profound effect on nausea and vomiting. We have many, many agents now, including anesthesia agents, that will treat or actually prevent nausea and vomiting. So things have changed quite a bit over the past 5 or 6 years.
But Sheila did say that it happens to women. Is it more likely to happen to women than men? Don't know, right?
Not sure.
Okay, well, here's James calling from a cell. Where are you, James? I hope it's not a prison cell.
No, I'm on Route 347 out in eastern Suffolk. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that I've had about 5 minor surgeries, and I'm the second one of them. I woke up while they were still stitching up my elbow. I had some tendonitis that they had to take care of. And I am a recovering alcoholic, and I'm just wondering, is it because of my high tolerance for drugs that I woke up during the procedure?
Well, certainly awareness under anesthesia is a major concern for us as anesthesiologists, and many anesthesiologists actually talk to their patients about this. Many of the instances of awareness are exactly as you described. It's that sense of awareness that you have as you're falling asleep or as you're waking up, as the last stitch is being placed, and it's not truly awareness under the anesthetic itself. However, some patients do report that they are aware of sounds and voices and feel that they can't move under anesthesia. This is a very, very rare event, and in almost all of those cases, the patients are not having pain. They just are aware. This will sometimes happen if the surgical procedure is an emergency procedure and for reasons of preserving life, the anesthesiologist feels that a deep level of anesthesia is inappropriate. Certainly some drugs, and alcohol is a drug, can affect the metabolism of anesthetic agents and their effectiveness and need to be taken into consideration. And it's why you have to be very honest with your anesthesiologist about what medicines you're taking and what your medical condition is in order to prevent a problem such as this.
Thank you for your call, James. My guests are Dr. William Schechter and Dr. Doris Cope, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. The topic of today's Please Explain is anesthesia and anesthesiology, and Tanya from, is it Hamlet or Hazlitt? Hazlitt, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I had a question. I've had two C-sections. The first one, they had to do emergency, so I was completely knocked out. The second one, they ended up giving me an epidural, and then I had to go in. And I wanted to know how you actually monitor and block that pain with the epidural, and is that something that's actually done by an anesthesiologist?
An epidural catheter is placed, and local anesthetic in a dilute amount is placed in the epidural space, which is the space above the dura or above the spine, and that makes those nerves somewhat numb, but you can titrate that or adjust that so only the sensory nerves are affected, and you might still have a little bit of motor function left, depending on if it's epidural for a C-section, a lot more local anesthetic is being used. If it's an epidural for pain relief during labor, then a lot less local anesthetic, a lot lighter concentration is used. And in my experience, those patients are monitored the very same way with all the monitors that you would get for a general anesthetic.
Okay.
Thank you for calling us. Susan from Long Island. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. I find this very interesting. I have two quick questions. One, I was wondering, do you think that circumcision is painful to the infant? Do they give them a local anesthetic? And two, I have a neighbor that had to undergo several surgeries with general anesthesia, and soon thereafter she developed Parkinson's. Is there any correlation whatsoever, or is that just a coincidence?
You should tackle the first one, Dr. Schechter.
Right. I can't really comment about someone's individual medical issues, but certainly the first one is something that is very interesting, and I have a little vignette about that. There are several very important pain researchers in Canada who have looked at the concept of circumcision, and several of the articles have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and what they looked at was they looked at behavior of children who were circumcised without anesthetic and compared that to children who received a topical anesthetic or a nerve block. And what they looked at was behavior at 2, 4, and 6 months when these children came for their immunizations, and they found a distinct difference. Now, some of that may be cultural, but some of that may, in fact, be related to the anesthetic. Several of the researchers up in Canada worked at the Jewish hospital up there where a Moyle is performing the procedure, and generally the patient gets a pre-medicant in the form of a sweet-tasting substance, Manischewitz-type wine, and there is also skin-to-skin contact. A relative holds the patient, and she looked at this very, very carefully, and she found two things. Number one, that local anesthetics applied sometimes in the form of a cream can be very effective in relieving pain behaviors, cry, and facial grimacing, and that the use of sucrose, 23% sucrose solution can also affect pain behavior. And this is sucrose given orally with a little binky, not injected. So there are pathways that somehow are activated by the taste of a sweet substance that will mitigate the effects of pain. And certainly skin-to-skin contact is very important. What does a child who is anxious or in pain say, hold my hand? And in point of fact, we are using the skin-to-skin contact in the neonatal intensive care unit in the form of a treatment called kangaroo care.
Is this something that is being accepted in the religious community?
Well, the religious community has accepted it for 5,000 years. We are beginning to accept
such things.
I'm talking
about local anesthesia.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But Dr. Cope, do you have any idea about the Parkinson's? Is that just a coincidence in your mind?
I don't know. I don't know.
You didn't see the patient.
Okay. History, family history, or I don't know of any correlation between multiple anesthetics and Parkinsonism.
Okay, let's go to Ed from Queens. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Yes, I was curious, the pulse ox monitor, does that take blood into it?
No, not at all. It is simply two wavelengths of light, an infrared wavelength and a red wavelength, and it's applied to your skin like a Band-Aid, and the hemoglobin that's oxygenated absorbs at one wavelength, and the hemoglobin that's not oxygenated absorbs light at another wavelength, and by that mechanism, we're able to tell how much oxygen is bound to hemoglobin, which is the very important red pigment in blood that carries oxygen to your vital organs.
Thank you for calling us. Kathy from Montclair. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Good afternoon, Leonard and doctors. I worked at a veterinary hospital, and the animals cry loudly when they come out of anesthesia. It almost sounds like they're in terrible pain. I know they're not. And my mother is an OR nurse, and she claims that people do this to some extent as well. I was just wondering, why is this? And I'll hang up and listen to the end.
Okay, thank you for calling us. Dr. Cope?
Oh, that's a hard one. Sometimes people come out of anesthesia and they're disoriented. They're not sure where they are or what's going on, and they thrash around. They're monitored to make sure they're getting oxygen and their vital signs are stable, but I think it's more of a disorientation.
Thank you for your call. Henry from Connecticut. Hi, you're on Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi. My call is with relation to the long-term effect, and by that I don't mean hours or even days. I mean months, perhaps, of response to a general anesthetic. Is that just rumor or is that fact?
That's a difficult question to answer, but it's something that individuals who are interested in geriatric anesthesia are looking at very carefully. Certainly, there can be a state of delirium which can exist in the time period after an anesthetic, and some of that may be due to pain or inadequate anesthesia, as Dr. Cope suggested. There are many drugs that are given acutely which may interact with one another and cause some cognitive dysfunction. But long-term effects of anesthesia is something that people worry about. It is extremely rare, and whether or not it is related to the anesthetic or the inflammatory response to surgery is something that is being seriously questioned now. There has been a large study done looking at regional anesthesia for total knee replacements and comparing cognitive function at the time of discharge from the hospital and then years later, and they find that the same degree of cognitive dysfunction is present, if it was present at discharge, even in the patients undergoing regional anesthesia.
Well,
so
listener,
it probably is more than just the general anesthetic itself.
Another listener wants to know about lightheaded spells in the 3 years since having surgery.
If she didn't have surgery on the central nervous system or the ear, it certainly is not something that I could ascribe to anesthesia.
Joe from Hoboken. Hi, you're on New York Public Radio. Joe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Thanks for putting me on. And I just have a sort of a funny story and a quick question that goes with it.
And it has to be very quick.
My uncle told me he had a surgery where his anesthesiologist came in afterward and told him that, or asked him actually, if he drank a lot, because he had to give him enough anesthesia to put down a horse. So I'm just curious if that would be true or not.
That would certainly is likely that if someone has a heavy alcohol intake, they metabolize drugs quicker. They have a high tolerance for analgesics and for barbiturates that may be used to put someone to sleep. So I've seen that many times. Someone who drinks a lot, their hepatic enzymes are actually more efficient because they're used to having to metabolize.
Is that something you would ask a patient?
We always ask, yes, if they're how much they drink, if they're a heavy drinker.
I want to thank you both so much for participating in today's edition of Please Explain. Dr. Doris Cope, Professor of Anesthesiology and Director of the Pain Medicine Program at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and Dr. William Schechter, Clinical Professor of Anesthesiology and Pediatrics at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia University. It's been a great pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.